ourselves up to speed and continue to try to end on time and do some catch-up announcements like we usually do at the beginning of class, at the end of class. So if you would, bow with me and we'll get started. Our Heavenly Father, we're thankful for this opportunity that we have to read and study through your word. We hope and pray that we will not only know more about who you are and what you are like, but that we will come to love you more and be better prepared to serve you, honor and glorify you by everything that we think, say, and do in life, especially as we treat each other and people around us. Help us to be consistent in living up to the name that we wear, that is the name of your Son, in whose name we pray. In Jesus the Christ's name we pray. Amen. All right, so very quickly, where we are in... I have to erase these bad graphics from Wednesday. I said I had to erase these bad graphics from... Oh, you didn't acknowledge it. Oh, man. We got to get some good markers. All right. So... the book of Genesis goes very, very quickly. Once you get past the creation account, things begin to slow down. Slows down a little bit for the Adam and Eve account, the Cain and Abel account, the genealogy from Genesis 5 into Genesis 6, which is the next major account in the biblical text, that is the story of Noah and his family in the flood. And then it goes quickly again through chapter 10 and 11, the genealogy in chapter 10, the account of Babel and getting up to Abraham. And then the story slows down in Genesis chapter 12. And Abraham is the central figure starting in Genesis chapter 12 for about the next 10 chapters or so. And in the course of Genesis chapter 12 and following, we see some central things that are going to define the rest of the biblical text, not only through the rest of Genesis, where we hope to finish this morning, but throughout the rest of the Old Testament and into the New Testament. So God makes a decision, and this decision that God makes related to the plan that he had back in Genesis 3:15, all right? So I apologize that some of the stuff is still on the board here. Genesis 3:15, God said that the seed of woman is ultimately going to triumph over Satan. And consistent with a seed promise that he makes here, God's going to make another seed promise here. This seed promise is not through Eve. This one's going to be through Abraham, initially called Abram. So we're just going to abbreviate here as Abraham. But he does more than just make a promise. He talks about some of the specifics that are going to be accomplished by means of this promise. That Abraham's descendants, one, that they're going to exist. He has none at this point. That he's going to be given land, and that he's going to be blessed, and those who bless him will be blessed, and those who curse him will be cursed. And then there's another contingent element that's brought out in this context, and that is God expected Abraham to be righteous. And so it's summed up in my language in Genesis 12 when God says, get up, get out. Leave where you are. He was told to leave family. He was told to leave his father's house. He was told to leave his country. And he leaves there, and he goes to Ur of the Chaldees, from Ur of the Chaldees to Haran, and then from Haran he goes to the land of Canaan. And he didn't know where he was going. And so there's an element of faith that comes into play with reference to Abraham, becomes a model for redemption today. Paul picks up on that in Romans chapter 4. Additionally, the covenant of righteousness, that's the language that's used by Zechariah, the father of John the Baptist, in Luke chapter 1, was one in which God anticipated all these blessings to come as a natural consequence of being faithful to him. Which means, you know, we see the song, sing the song, trust and obey. And that biblical premise of trust, that is confidence, placing faith in God, demands that we will yield to him. Jesus brought that out in John chapter 8 when he was talking to the religious leaders who came to believe in him because of his word, John 8:31. But they didn't yield their lives to him as Abraham did. Yet they claimed to be the children of Abraham. And Jesus said, it's true, you are the children of Abraham genetically, genealogically, hereditarily. But in character, you're not quite like him. If you were the children of Abraham, spiritually speaking, you'd do what Abraham did. What's that mean? You would believe what God wants you to believe, and you would act accordingly. And so this promise that starts here in Genesis chapter 12 is repeated in 15, repeated in 17 to Abraham, and then after that to Isaac and to Jacob. And those are the next two generations after Abraham. And then something changes. It's not changes from the standpoint of the promise and the content of the promise, but the application becomes more widespread. Jacob becomes Israel. That is, his name is changed after he wrestles with a theophany of God and an angelic being of some sort, a representation of God, and was blessed by him in Genesis chapter 32. And his name becomes Israel. That is, one who strives with or a prince of God. And the name Israel not only applied to Jacob, but two chapters later it applies to Jacob's family. He wrought folly in Israel, not just me, but in the extended family. And then the name Israel becomes a national name. So it's no longer just a man, it's a nation. So the promise that starts here in Genesis 12, in Abraham, continues in 15, didn't write on the board in 17, becomes the promise to the next generation, Isaac, to the next generation, Jacob, to the nation that's going to develop through him. And that's what's developing where we are in this part of the book of Genesis. So we're reviewing quickly to bring us up to where we want to take up where we left off last Sunday night as we were reviewing the text. So we're reading roughly 3 or 4 chapters a day. And every time we get together Sunday morning and Sunday night, we're reviewing about 10 chapters at a time, keeping close to where we are in our reading. So in our reading, we're going to be into Exodus 3 for today. We're going to finish Exodus this morning, and then tonight we'll get into the first 10 chapters of Exodus in our review, so we'll be a little bit ahead, but we'll catch back up in our reading through the week. So what's going on in this context? I don't have it here, so let me write it. In Genesis chapter 15, God elaborates, God expands upon the promise that he made in Genesis chapter 12. Seed, land, blessings. Seed, land, blessings. Well, in Genesis 15, it opens with Abraham asking God a question. I don't have any children. I have this man, Eliezer, who's from Damascus, who is a steward in my household. And if anybody's going to get anything, he's likely the only heir that I'm going to have. Now, we see later that he had a large contingent of people working for him, at his own army that he went out to rescue Lot and his family of more than 300, but Eliezer is the main guy. He says, is he going to be the heir? And God says, no, it's going to be literally your child. And let me tell you how you're going to know this. I'm going to tell you more about what's going to happen. Not that just you're going to have seed, but how that's going to develop. He says, your seed, referring to your descendants, are going to go into a land. They're going to be oppressed. And I'm going to bring them out to this place. That anticipates what we're reading in this section in Genesis, where we're about to take up with reference to the story of Joseph. Joseph is the key connection that fulfills this promise that God makes to in Genesis 15 to Abraham. Your seed will go into a land that's not theirs, which means not the land of Canaan where Abraham was standing at this point, and they're going to be oppressed, and I'm going to deliver them and bring them back to this place. So this expanded promise that first is given in chapter 12 is going to dominate the rest of the book of Genesis. So Abraham is now died. Isaac is now died. Jacob is the one who is the last of the three great patriarchs that are mentioned. And Jacob has 12 sons. He has 12 sons by 2 wives and 2 concubines, or 2 handmaids of each of his wives. And those sons are Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin. And he has a daughter, Dinah. And so they become, that is, the 12 sons become the heads of the tribes of Israel, or the tribes of Jacob. Now there are 12 tribes. When they ultimately get into the land, that's coming a little bit later in our Old Testament reading, when they get into the land, the numbering of them and the naming of them is a little bit different. Levi doesn't inherit land, but inherit city in the northern part of the kingdom and on the other side of the river and so forth, scattered throughout the land. So they don't receive a land inheritance like everybody else does. And so that takes one away. So how do we get 12? Joseph doesn't inherit land in his name, but in the name of his 2 sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And because of that, we still have 12 names, but the 12 sons of Judah are represented slightly differently. Joseph receives a double portion because of what we're going to see in the rest of the book of Genesis. So, what happens now? Joseph had 12 sons. Joseph was something special because Joseph was the firstborn son of Rachel, who was the one that Jacob labored for 7 years intending to marry. Only he was deceived at the last moment by his father-in-law, Laban, and swapped Leah out.
You might say, well, how could that happen? Well, marriages didn't work like they did now. You know, it was a deceptive thing. When Rebecca came to Isaac, and she saw him, and she asked the man, the steward who went to bring her back from the land from whence Abraham's family had come, who is this man? Well, that's my master's son. That's the one you're going to marry. And the marriage ceremony consisted in that they went into their tent, the marriage was consummated, and they become a husband and wife. You say, well, we don't do that today. And that's my point. They did things a little bit differently then. So in this context, he was able to be duped, that is, Jacob was able to be duped by his father-in-law. He works another 7 years. He's already going to be married to Rachel. And then the process of all the children being born is brought out. So the firstborn son of Rachel is Joseph. And Joseph was favored by his father. As we read through the text, we see that's going to cause a lot of problems. What kind of problems does it cause? Well, one, he favored him in name. He favored him in things that he gave to him. He had this multi-piece coat that we often refer to as a multicolored coat. And he was kind of the guy that his dad used to check up on the rest of the brothers. And the brothers resented him for that. In addition to that, he began to express dreams that he had. Remember, there are two series of dreams. First series of dreams was about sheaves, all right? Through the harvest time, and they bring everything together, and he says his sheaf was in the center, and everybody else that was represented by a sheaf, they came and bowed down to him. And that caught people's attention. In the next dream, he was kind of the center of the solar universe, and all the rest of the planets, referring not only to his brothers, but even his dad, came and bowed down to him. And his dad even said something about it. What in the world are you talking about? Now, the brothers were angered about it, but his dad kept those things in mind. So those dreams were not just Joseph dreaming about being a big guy and beating up on everybody else and dominating everybody. They were prophetic dreams that God had given to Joseph to talk about what was going to happen in the future. Now, here's what's interesting. In order for those dreams to be fulfilled, there's a lot of junk that had to happen in the meantime. And that's what we see in the latter part of the book of Genesis, the junk that happens in the meantime. So, as we take up where we are in this context, let's go to the chapters where we left off before. All right. So, Joseph goes to watch after his brothers and to check up on his brothers. And when he comes, they plot against him, and some of them want him to be killed. So if you're reading through the text, some of them want them to be killed. Reuben kind of speaks up for his defense, puts him into a pit, leaves, and when he comes out back, he finds out that the brothers sold him into slavery. And so you'll see two different names that are mentioned there, the Ishmaelites and the Midianites, that seem to be different names for the same group of people. And they're traveling through, and they're going to go into the land of Egypt, where they in turn sell Joseph into Potiphar's household. More about that in just a second. So now, the beloved son of Jacob has been sold into slavery, and the boys have to go back and tell Daddy what happened to the beloved son. So what's the plan that they hatch? They take his coat, they slaughter an animal, and they drench the coat, as it were, in the animal's blood, and they bring it back to their father, and it doesn't say in the text that they said anything. The father draws a conclusion. He's been slain by wild animals, been killed by wild animals, and he is no more. Now, let's just think about this for a second. That's pretty mean. That's pretty low-down, dirty mean, you know? That's just not very kind. But it shows you something about the animus that existed between the brothers and Joseph. That they didn't think that highly of him to respect him as a brother, and that they sold him into slavery. And for 20 years, they don't know anything about what happened to Joseph. They don't know whether or not he's alive or dead. From his father's perspective, he's been dead from the time that they brought the coat back. So you can imagine when it comes up later in the account, when they find out that Joseph is alive, the brothers find out first, and then they go back and tell their father that he didn't believe it. You know, this can't be, you know. Now, there's nothing in the text that tells us at any point where Jacob said to the brothers, now, how is it that he could be alive when you brought me a coat that was just, you know, slathered in blood from an animal? There's no discussion of that happening. But I can't imagine, and again I'm saying, I can't imagine that that never crossed his father's mind. How could this be that you presented this coat this way, and all these years later, he's still alive? You know, what kind of conniving went on in order to accomplish that? So, let's talk about what goes on in Joseph's life as we're going through these things. So, the Bible teaches, and this is a significant thing, that Joseph was not only favored by his father, because he was the firstborn of his beloved wife, Rachel. And he's not only treated, you know, especially by his father, he's not only the one who goes and checks up on the other brothers and has his special coat, but as Joseph is sold into slavery by his brothers, first the Ishmaelites and Midianites, and then into Potiphar, that God blesses him. God blesses him. So when he's in Potiphar's household, he's in charge of everything. And there's absolutely nothing that he doesn't have any control over, with one exception, and that's Potiphar's wife. Potiphar trusts him. He blesses him. Potiphar's successful because of him and so forth. And so he's away from his family. He's been sold into slavery. He's a servant in Potiphar's household, so he's not free by any means. But yet he's being blessed. Then the circumstances of Potiphar's wife, who was eyeing him on a regular basis, and he's constantly rejecting her advances. On one day, he goes into the house, and unlike most of the times, there's nobody else there but him. So there's nobody else that's in the employ of Potiphar that's around. And so they're by themselves. And she again attempts to seduce him, and he doesn't want to do that. And it's incredible what he says. Anybody remember what he says? He doesn't just rebuke her or rebuff her. He says, how can I do this and sin against God? Now that's significant. Excuse me? And so what's interesting there is now, how much time had elapsed since he'd been away from his father's brothers? Don't know. The total time is going to be about 20 years. So here he is in a foreign land all by himself. The only quote-unquote Hebrew there, which is the name that's initially given to Abraham a couple of generations back. The only young Jewish boy that's there, the only Hebrew boy that's there. And he's maintaining his integrity from the standpoint of what he believes and what he practices. So the problem is he flees, only she has his coat. And as he flees, she hollers out, and people come in and says, look what this guy's done. Look what this Hebrew boy has done. He's tried to attack me. And look, I've got his coat here. So that proves from her perspective that he was trying to do something wrong. It proves from God's perspective that he fled and didn't stay there and succumb to anything else, even though he was going to be accused of something. So Joseph goes to prison when Potiphar finds this out. And so you might think, well, he was sold into captivity. His brothers wanted to kill him. Reuben didn't want that to happen. And so Reuben comes back. He's no longer in the pit. They sell him into captivity. He's a slave or a steward in Potiphar's household. And now he's in prison. So, you know, the story's not going very well here. And so in the course of being in prison, here's what we see next. He meets two individuals, the baker and the butler, both of whom were servants of Pharaoh. And both of them are in prison. Because in some way they had offended Pharaoh. So they're there for some time, and each of them have dreams, and Joseph is going to interpret their dreams for them. So the significance of dreams is brought out many times in the text as a whole, in the biblical text as a whole, but especially in the life of Joseph. So we've already seen two dreams, the dreams of the sheaves, the dreams of the sun and the moon and the stars. Now we're going to see the dreams of the butler and the baker. And then later, we're going to see the dreams of Pharaoh himself, which is going to be a higher point in Joseph's life, to say the least. So each of these two men have dreams, and Joseph interprets their dreams, tells them the significance of their dreams. The baker's dream is that, you know, birds come and pluck and all the cakes and so forth on his head. And he says, well, this means you're going to, within 3 days, you're going to be returned to Pharaoh and you're going to be killed. But the butler is going to be returned to Pharaoh, and you're going to be blessed. You're going to be back in his service. And so the butler forgets Joseph when he gets back. All right? As you read through the text, 2 years have elapsed when you get to chapter 41. And all of a sudden, dreams come up again. Only this time, Pharaoh has dreams. And the butler remembers, aha, when I was in prison, there was this Hebrew lad that was there who interpreted dreams of myself and the baker, and each of the dreams came true exactly as he said they were, and that's why I'm here today. And so Joseph is brought before Pharaoh. He correctly interprets the dream. So here are the dreams that Pharaoh had. Remember, there are seven stalks, fat stalks, grain harvest that was full. And then seven lean stalks come up, and they devour the fat ones. And then the same dream is repeated, only in different illustration. There are seven very well-fed cows that come out of the Nile, and seven very sickly, ugly cows that come out, and the sickly ones consume the others. And Pharaoh's going, what is this about? And so Joseph interprets the dreams. He says, the dreams are what? You might say, well, the dreams are two. There's two of them. But he meant their dreams are one in meaning. The same meaning applies to each. And he interprets to say that there are going to be 7 years of plenty, in which there's going to be abundance of produce that's going to be yielded in the land, but it's going to be followed by 7 years of famine. What you need to do, this is what Joseph says. Oh, incidentally, when Joseph has the dreams to the baker and the butler, to whom does he give credit for the interpretation of those dreams? To God. When he speaks to Pharaoh, even before he tells him the dreams and their meaning, he does the same thing. So repeatedly, Joseph is about giving credit and honor and respect to God, as he should. So he suggests to Pharaoh that they get somebody who's going to be able to take advantage of the 7 years of abundance to plan for the 7 years of famine. And Pharaoh thinks that's a good idea. And he's standing there in his court. He says, who better than you? Who better than you? And so here's Joseph, despised by his brothers, dead from his dad's perspective, sold into slavery, initially to the Ishmaelites / Midianites, sold into servitude in Potiphar's household, in prison, and now he arises to be second in command over all Pharaoh, with one exception. Pharaoh's still Pharaoh. He's still the leader. And so Joseph rises to a position of prominence. So when you get into this context, you're going to see the 7 years of prosperity come, the 7 years of famine come, and they're putting away food like crazy for 7 years so that there's an abundance of food. Now, when you stop and think about it, you might think, well, in 7 years, they must have produced not only enough for each year, but enough for the 7 years to come. So they must have been producer bumper crops during the time of the seven. So he says it's going to be a year, a time of plenty. So sometimes crops produce much more than usual. In this context, it's going to go on in 7 years. So when you get to chapter 42, we are past the time of the abundance, and we're into the famine. But the famine doesn't just impact the land of Egypt. It impacts surrounding areas. As you get into the 42nd chapter and following chapters, you see that the famine's also impacting Jacob and his sons. There are 11 of them now, because the 12th one, Joseph, is assumed dead by his dad anyway, and presumably by his brothers. And the famine's impacting them as well. So the word is out that there's not food here, but there's food in Egypt. And so Jacob sends the boys to Egypt, and he says, go and bring food back to us. So the brother's going to go. So look at chapter 42, and we'll slow down a little bit here. When Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, why do you look at one another? Opening verse of 42. He said, indeed, I've heard that there's grain in Egypt. Go down to that place and buy for us there, that we may live and not die. So they have no idea about what's happened in the last 20 years or so. They don't know. They are totally oblivious to that. So Joseph's 10 brothers went down to Egypt to buy grain. Now, I mentioned before that there were 11. Why does it say only 10 went? It means one didn't go. Benjamin stayed behind. So Benjamin kind of becomes the de facto replacement for Joseph. Joseph was the firstborn son of the beloved Rachel. And for all practical purposes, he was dead to Jacob, because hadn't seen him in all these years. Coats brought back, soaked in blood, and he assumes he's dead, torn by wild beasts. So Benjamin is now the favored son. And so he's not going to allow him to go with the brothers. So the brothers go into the land of Egypt. So let's get into the rest of the story. Didn't send Benjamin, lest some calamity fall him, verse 4. sons of Israel, they go and buy grain for the families in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was the governor in the land, verse 6, and everybody who came had to go through him. And watch verse 6, last part of it. Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces on the earth. Faces to the earth. There's a sheaf illustration and the stars and so forth illustration that's going to come later when his father comes. They don't recognize that they are bowing down before their younger brother who had prophesied something like this years before. But it happens anyway. Joseph recognized them, but they did not recognize him. So by this time, he's the second in command. He acted as a stranger, spoke roughly to them, and he begins to ask questions of them, which from our perspective shows that Joseph knew what was going on, but they didn't see this. So he asks a very open-ended question. Where do you come from? We come from the land of Canaan. What are you doing here? Well, we came to buy some food. He recognizes them. They didn't recognize him. And Joseph remembered the dreams which he dreamed about them and said to them, "You're spies. You've come to see the nakedness, that is, to see what's going on in the land." And they said, no, we just came to buy food. Now watch this. They volunteer this information, and Joseph runs with it. They volunteer this information. "We're all one man's sons. We are honest men." Now, that's interesting. You know, it's interesting because they weren't so honest in the way they dealt with their baby brother, before whom they're speaking at this point. But he doesn't say anything. That's not going to come to later. All right, "We're honest men. We're one man's sons." And he said, no, "You've come to see the nakedness of the land. You're here, you're spies." And they said, "No, watch. Your servants are 12 brothers. And there's only 10. All right, so Joseph can do the math. You're 12 brothers? What about the other two?" They're going to explain. "The sons of one man in the land of Canaan, and in fact, the youngest, Benjamin, is with our father today. And watch, one is no more." The one who's no more is standing in front of them listening to them. They don't know that. He does. So this is an interesting dynamic. I get the cold feeling running up down your spine when I read about this. This is just incredible. All right. So they said, "You're the servants of, your servants," not to say call themselves servants, 12 brothers, "sons of one man, youngest is with their father, one's no more." Joseph said, "It is as I spoke to you." He keeps hammering this spy thing. "In this manner you shall be tested by the life of Pharaoh." Watch this now. They've let it be known that Benjamin's still alive, all right? That the youngest is with the father. "In this manner we're going to test you by the life of Pharaoh. You shall not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here." Now Joseph's doing that for a number of reasons, from their perspective, to prove whether or not they're telling the truth. "How do I know you're telling the truth? How do I know your dad's alive? How do I know you have another brother? You got to bring him back here, all right?" He knows they're telling the truth, but they don't know that he knows that yet. "Send one of you and let him bring your brother, and the rest of you are going to be kept in prison." So the initial plan was, one of you go back, bring that younger brother here, and then I'll let the rest of you go. All right, that's going to change in a little bit. All right, you're going to be kept in prison to find out whether or not this is true. This is verse 16. So he put them in prison for 3 days. You know, Joseph's playing this for all it's worth. You know, he's going to make them suffer a little bit here. And you might say, well, this is kind of mean. Just remember, he didn't sell them into slavery and send them away, and 20 years later, you know, bump into them like what's happening here. So 3 days later, Joseph said to them, "Do this and live, for I fear God. If you're honest men, let one of your brothers stay here." So he swaps it. One was going to go bring Benjamin back. Now one stays and the rest of you go. All right, "If you're honest men, do this and you're going to live. One of your brothers be confined. You go and carry grain for the family in your houses and bring your youngest back to me to verify your words." Verse 20. Then they said to one another, watch this in verse 21. Remember they earlier said, "We are honest men, the sons of one man." All right. "We are truly guilty concerning our brother." Watch this. "We are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear." Joseph didn't go quietly as he sold to the Ishmaelites / Midianites into servitude by his brothers nearly 20 years before. And that haunts them as they're standing before Joseph. You know, what we did is coming back to us. "We would not hear, therefore this distress has come upon us." Watch what Reuben said. Did I not speak to you, verse 22, do not sin against the boy, and you would not listen. Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us. Now, the blood that they sent on the coat to the father wasn't his blood, it was animal blood. But they're assuming by this point, he's dead. And this is haunting us even to this point. They didn't understand that Joseph understood them, didn't know that because Joseph spoke through an interpreter. So he understood what they were saying. So he is not speaking to them in his own language. He's speaking through an interpreter to them. And so from their perspective, he's an Egyptian. From their perspective, he's Pharaoh's right-hand man. That's all they know. He turned himself away from them and wept. Then he returned to them again. And he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. So now you go back, you bring this boy back to me, and I'll let Simeon go. All right, so I'm not going to read through the rest of the text as slow as I just did. Here's what goes back. They go back to the land of Canaan. So they take food, all the grain that they bought. And in the context of the story, as they open up their sacks, they find out all the money that they took to buy the food is back in the sack. What in the world's going on here? They're thinking, this doesn't make any sense. How can this be? So when they camp, they opened up and they see all their money's in there. And watch what they say in verse 28, the last few verses, the words there. What is this that God has done to us? So they've got guilty consciences here, you know. First remark was, you know, all this has happened to us because we didn't listen to Joseph as he pled with us. And Reuben says, I told you, don't do any harm to that child. His blood is now on our head. Now, when they open the money and they're looking at us, look, it's going to look like we stole the grain and kept their money. All right? God's done this to us. So they went to Jacob, their father, and they told them about the Lord of the land who spoke roughly with us. He still had no idea who it is. And they said, he accused us of being spies. We said, we're not spies. We have 12 brothers, one's no more. Notice they repeat that to the father. The youngest is with their father. He says, you can't have your brother Simeon back until you bring that guy back to me, Benjamin, to prove it to me. And Jacob's initial response was, no way. No way. I've lost the oldest child of my beloved Rachel. I'm not going to lose the younger. So the food that they bought eventually is going to run out. So the solution to more food is, where's the food? In Egypt. We can't go back to Egypt. We can't go back to Egypt without bringing Benjamin. Remember, Simeon's still, you know, held there. So they're going to find out, and we mentioned this already, one found the money, all of them found the money. And so Joseph is no more, Simeon is no more, and you want to take Benjamin away? Verse 36, he says, I can't let that happen. So Reuben speaks up and he says, you can kill my two sons if I don't bring him back. So they're getting pretty desperate here. If I can't go back to the land and bring back Simeon after we've took Benjamin, you can kill my sons in their place. Well, that doesn't replace Joseph. That doesn't replace anything that might happen to Simeon or Benjamin. But they're desperate to have these things go in a way that they're going to be able to get food and resolve the dilemma that Joseph prayed before them. He said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead. Notice, everybody keeps referring to Jacob, Joseph as if he's dead. And this one's left alone. Any calamity befalls him, and he says, I might as well die too. His death would mean my death. So, chapter 43, we're going to go back to this, what happens next. And we'll go through this very quickly. Famine was severe, came to pass, they'd eaten up the grain, so they've got to go back. And they said, we can't go back without Benjamin. And he finally relents, and he's going to take him back. All right? So let's jump ahead, verse 12. Their father says, take double money back. The money that you paid for the first time you fought, but it was returned to you. You take money back, but then you take other gifts. So there was some produce in the land that they had, but evidently not grain. And he says, God give you mercy before these men, that he may release your other brother and Benjamin. If I'm bereaved, I'm bereaved. So they left, took double money. They saw come to Joseph, and watch what we see in verse 16. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the stewards of his house, take these men to my home and slaughter an animal and make ready, for these men will dine with me at noon. So they're taken to Joseph's house, and he's going to put on a feast for them. The men did as Joseph ordered. The men brought the men into Joseph's house, and they were afraid because they were brought into Joseph's house. And they said, it's because of the money which was returned in our sacks the first time that we're brought in. He's going to seek an occasion to do something against us. So when they drew near to the stewards of Joseph's house, they talked to him. They said, listen, We came down the first time to buy food, verse 20, and when we stopped, we found out one of us had money, and when we got back home, we all had our money. We don't know who did that. And so what's interesting is, the steward knew, but he said, peace be with you. Watch this. Do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given your treasure in your sacks. I had your money. And he brought Simeon out to that. Now that's interesting. What does he know about God? Who would have had any input in his life to know who God was? I suspect it was the man in whose employ he was, Joseph. So we're going to see something else distinct. And remember we mentioned before, Joseph's by himself with Potiphar's wife. No family, nobody else around, no Hebrews around and whatever, and he maintains his integrity. We're going to see that's going to come up again. All right, so in addition to what we see here, so they brought these men into his house, they gave them water, they washed their feet, gave their donkeys food, and they made ready for Joseph's coming, for they heard that he's going to be with them. So they not only brought him to Joseph's house, Joseph is going to join them. So when Joseph came home, they brought them the presents that they brought back from their father, and he asked them about their well-being. Is the father, the old man of whom you spoke, that's his dad, is he still alive? And they answered, your servant, notice that, your servant. The first time when they came, they said, we are your servants. And now they're referring to their dad as Joseph's servant. And they bowed down their heads, prostrated themselves before them. He saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son. Is this your younger brother of whom you spoke? And he said, God be gracious to you. Now notice, the steward made reference to God, the God of your fathers, not just any old God, because there was a plethora, a pantheon of gods, if you will, in Egypt. More about that in Exodus. His heart yearned for his brother. Joseph made haste and sought somewhere to weep, and he went into his chamber to weep. Washed his face, comes out, served them food. Now watch what we see in verse 32 and following. They set him a place by himself, and them by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat with the Hebrews, for that's an abomination to the Egyptians. Now, there are three groups of people. The Egyptians by themselves, Joseph by himself. Now, I don't know how much the brothers are paying attention to. They might have been thinking, well, maybe he's the leader and they don't deserve to eat with him. But it's not just the leader thing, it's he's also a Hebrew. They don't know that he's a Hebrew because they don't know it's Joseph. So the brothers are by themselves, the Egyptians are there eating by themselves, and Joseph is by himself. So they couldn't eat food with the Hebrews. They sat there for the firstborn according to his birthright to the youngest. So they order them in age. And the brothers recognize that. What's going on here? How in the world would these, you know, Egyptian stewards know to order us this way? And on top of that, Benjamin's serving was five times what everybody else's was. So there's special deference shown to Benjamin here. What's going on? What does this mean? So Joseph told the stewards, you know, fill them in sacks with food as much as they can carry, put their money back in it, and also put my cup. And the cup is going to be interesting. So he's going to send the boys away, all of them away this time, right? The 11. 10 came the first time. Benjamin's with them this time. He's the 12. And he puts all the money back in there from the first and the second time, and he puts a special cup in there, and he refers to that as a cup of divination that plays in the story. And so, put my cup there. Put it in the mouth of the youngest one. Alright? So when they'd gone out from the city, not very far, the steward said, Joseph said to the steward, verse 4, go after them, overtake them. And they said, you know, why did you steal our master's cup? They don't know what in the world he's talking about. It's the one from which the Lord drinks, and, you know, he practices divination with that. Now, Joseph didn't do that, but that's the story they were told. So, we brought you back from the land of Canaan, the money we found, the mouth in our sacks. How would we steal silver from him? We didn't do that. And he says, wherever you find this cup, in whoever's bag, let him be dead. Well, they find it in Benjamin's cup. All right? So, this is all part of the plan. All right? So, they're just horrified. And so, they're all brought back before Joseph. So this is the climax of what's going to happen. Verse 6:18, Judah came near to him. This is back before Joseph came near to him. He says, oh my Lord, please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's hearing, and do not let your anger burn against your servant, for you are even like Pharaoh, which was true. Chapter 41, verse 40 tells us that. My Lord asked his servants, do you have a father? Do you have a brother? And we said, yeah, we've got a father. He's an old man. And we've got a child of his old age who's young. His brother's dead. Notice the number of times they keep referring to Jacob, to Joseph as his dad. He alone is left of his mother's children. His father loves him. You said, bring him back. So we went and told our dad that. And he says, no, you can't do that. You know, I'll die if you do that. But we did it anyway. Unless your youngest brother comes back, you're not going to see my face again. And you'll never see Simeon again either. So it was, verse 24, we went up to your servant, my father. Notice the number of times he keep referring to Jacob as Joseph's servant. We told him these words, and he said, we can't do this. We can't go back and buy food unless he comes. So we did that. And so the young one went out from me, and I said, surely he is torn to pieces. Again, referring to what they assume had happened. He assumed Jacob had happened to Joseph. Now therefore, when I came to your servant, my father, and the lad's not with us, since his life is bound up with his the lad's life, it will happen when he sees that the lad's not with us, he's going to die. You know, you're going to keep him because he's guilty of something. So don't do this. Drop down to verse 45. Chapter 45. Joseph couldn't restrain himself any longer. So here's where everything comes out in the open. So he sent everybody out. Nobody's there except Joseph and his brothers, and he's weeping aloud. So loud that the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. They're not in the room, but they heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, imagine being there, not seeing him for 20 years, and this man, whom you assume is second command in all of Egypt, who's been speaking harshly to you, speaking through an interpreter before, says to you, in his language, their language, I'm Joseph. Does my father still live? Response of his brothers, brothers couldn't answer him. Verse 3, for they were dismayed in his presence. What does this mean? Just a reminder here. When the apostles first saw the Lord in Luke chapter 24, they thought it was a ghost and they didn't believe it was him. They didn't believe the two women who'd gone to the tomb, didn't believe the two men who saw him en route to Emmaus. Jesus rebuked them in their presence for not believing. Twice witnesses have been presented to them. So when Jesus appeared in their midst, they didn't believe it. They're stunned, like, this can't be true. And so they're dismayed. They don't know what to think about it. Joseph said to his brothers, come near to me. And they came near and he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. Whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not therefore be grieved nor angry. Watch this with yourselves, because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. His life wasn't lost. His life was sacrificed of a sort for the preservation of life. For these 2 years, the famine has been in the land, and there will be 5 more years. So it's going to get worse before it's going to get better. And so he says, this is what you do. God sent me here. He says that already. God sent me here. So it was not you, but God who sent me here. Verse 8. So you go to your father, and you tell him, your son Joseph has been made Lord over all of Egypt, and God did that. You need to come here. And so now all of the descendants of Abraham that he was promised in Genesis chapter 12, in chapter 15 he says, you're going to go into a land that's not yours, and you're going to be afflicted there, and then I will deliver you and bring you to this place. That's Exodus chapter 2 and 3 and following. What happens in Genesis 15, the promise is about to come to reality here. The first part of that. All of Jacob's descendants, 70 to 75, depending which text you look at and who's counted, are all going to end up in the land of Egypt. And it's a good thing at first, because they escape the famine that's in the land of Canaan. So, chapter 46, Jacob moves to Egypt. We're going to go quickly in the next few minutes here to catch up. So Jacob finds out that his son's still alive. Israel takes his journey with all that he has, comes to Beersheba, offers sacrifices, chapter 46, to the God of his father Isaac. In another text, it would be referred to as the God of Abraham as well. God spoke to Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. So this is the old man who thought that Joseph was dead. He says, I am the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt. Watch this, for I will make of you a great nation there. The promise made to Abraham in chapter 12 is fulfilled in part by going into the land of Egypt, and they become a great nation there. So they are a nation within a nation there. They're a nation without a country. They don't have a land yet. But that's going to come at the end of their period of their affliction. So he says, don't worry about it. I'm going to go down with you, verse 4, and I will also surely bring you up again. Same promise that was made to Abraham. So in Abraham's setting in Genesis 15, it's anticipated. Starting in chapter 46 and following, it's being fulfilled. And so the reality is coming about. I'm going to bring you up again, and Joseph will put his hand on your eyes. And so Joseph is going to be there at the time that you die. So they bring all their livestock, they bring all their goods, and it lists all the genealogy of all the sons that are born, starting in verses 8, 9, and 10, that goes on through the rest of the chapter. Verse 28, Judah goes before him to Joseph, and they appoint them to be in this land, given the land of Goshen. Chapter 47, Joseph went and told Pharaoh, listen, my dad's coming, my brothers are coming, all their family's coming. And he presents the brothers before Pharaoh, and he finally presents his father before Pharaoh. And he says, you're welcome in the land. You know, everybody thinks Joseph's great. He's done all these things to solve the problems of the famine and to take care of everything based upon the 7 years of plenty. And so they are welcomed with great fanfare when they first come. All right? So chapter 47, 13 and following, Joseph is dealing with the famine, and people are running out of food and they're running out of everything else. And so now they're selling their lands and their livestock to Joseph, that is to Pharaoh, so they could have food. And so Pharaoh's going to grow to be in great wealth. End of the chapter, verse 27 following, we'll take up tonight at 48 and go further. Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen, had possessions, and they grew and multiplied exceedingly. Remember the beginning of 46, he says, don't be afraid to go into the land of Egypt. I'm going to bless you. You're going to have everything that you need. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years, and Jacob's going to die there. And he says, don't let me be buried in Egypt. Take me back to where I'm from. We're going to talk about that more later. All right, so we're going to take up a chapter 48 next time. Any questions or comments before we...
Goshen was a fertile area. It's a prime real estate, prime farming,
right.
Prime air, water, prime everything.
Which is what they needed for all their livestock. And the other thing was, they were separate and distinct from the Egyptians, so they weren't the abomination that the Egyptians considered them, in light of the fact that Joseph was Pharaoh, they kept them distinct. And that's going to be maintained. Evelyn. Right. Right.
And they went back to their father. They couldn't say that.
Yeah.
And that's a good example of how deceit destroys relationships. When people are honest about their mistakes, they should and they can receive forgiveness, comfort, like what Joseph gave them later. But they couldn't even receive that from their dad because they couldn't admit to them yet.
They were all in the same, you know, pot together, the same rotten kettle of fish as it were, but their dad wasn't in on it. So they couldn't tell him that.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Good point. Yes, I'm sorry.
One thing. Twice, Joseph was convicted by evidence of his coming.
You mean Jacob was?
No, Joseph.
I'm
convicted because they took his coat back to his dad.
Oh, I got you. And then, yes, I've got you. Yes. I'm sorry. I missed that. Right. I got you. I was thinking about, you know, his father's coming. No, I see what you're saying. That's a good point. Good point. All right. Yes, Sharon.
What the age range of the sons were at the point of this starting?
Now, that's a good question. I'd have to look into that. I don't know. From Reuben, the oldest, to the youngest, Benjamin, I'd have to look into that. I don't know what they were. If you read in the text when all the births were taking place, they'd spanned over multiple years. And so what the oldest age was and the youngest, I don't know. But that's a good point. Good question. I have to look into that. All right. Before we dismiss...